the special area in and around Tushkpuk Lake are very crucial for wildlife species such as caribou, molting geese.
The Bureau of Land Management considers leasing areas of the NPRA that were previously off limits. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the difficulty in attracting teachers to Alaska amid a national shortage.
You've got to convince somebody to come to Bush, Alaska, where we have some teacher housing that doesn't have running water. They have honey buckets.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
The Trump administration is taking a first step toward potentially opening up new parts of Alaska to oil drilling. The Bureau of Land Management announced today that it will consider allowing oil development in parts of the National Petroleum Reserve on Alaska's North Slope that are currently protected. The reserve is an Indiana-sized chunk of federal land west of Prudhoe Bay. The BLM is asking for input on what parts of the reserve should be available for drilling, including areas that were blocked off from oil and gas leasing under the Obama administration. BLM spokesperson Leslie Ehlers-Waters says the announcement is a direct result of an order signed by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke when he visited Alaska this spring. It ordered the agency to review the existing plan.
His direction was to review that integrated activity plan to ensure that we're promoting a balance of, you know, conservation and development.
Ellis Waters says the 11 million acres that are now blocked off won't be available at this year's oil and gas lease sale. At this point, she says, the Interior Department is just gauging industry interest in the region. And there may be a lot of interest from the oil industry. There have been several big oil discoveries in and around the National Petroleum Reserve in the past year. According to BLM, some of the area that's now off limits has high potential for oil and gas development. But Susan Colini of Audubon, Alaska, says that part of the reserve was protected for a reason. It's near a giant lake that's key habitat for many species.
Tushkpuk Lake, the special area in and around Tushkpuk Lake, are very crucial for wildlife species such as caribou, molting geese. Hundreds of thousands of shorebirds congregate in that area.
The deadline for public comment is September 7th. Starting today, the U.S. Coast Guard is holding 2 weeks of public hearings as part of its investigation into the sinking of the fishing vessel Destination. All six crew members died when the crab boat disappeared in February near St. George Island, marking the deadliest accident in more than a decade for the Bering Sea crab fleet. The vessel's wreckage was finally located last month, but investigators are still trying to determine why the Destination sank. This week, Coast Guard officials will interview witnesses about the state of the vessel, as well as the human and weather factors that may have played a role in the sinking. Former Alaska legislator Drew Pierce has a new job in the Trump administration. Pierce is now the deputy administrator of PHMSA. That's the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, part of the U.S. Department of Transportation. PHMSA oversees the nation's network of pipelines, some 2.3 million miles, and the transportation of hazardous materials in general by road, rail, or air. Pierce says she was sworn in this morning.
We look at safety first, then building infrastructure, new infrastructure, as well as maintaining the infrastructure we already have is our second goal. And then technology and research is the third goal.
Pierce represented Anchorage in the state Senate and became Senate president. She resigned her seat in 2001 to be a senior advisor at the Interior Department. President George W. Bush later appointed her to be the first federal coordinator for the Alaska Gas Line project. She maintains homes in Anchorage and outside Washington, D.C., where her new position is based. With only a few weeks to go until the new school year begins, about half of Alaska's school districts are still looking for 228 teachers and special educators to hire. KTOO's Quinton Chandler reports a national teacher shortage is hurting the search.
Close your eyes and just imagine you're fresh out of school, broke, and you're hunting for your first teaching job. Suddenly, you're in demand. A school district offers you a job paying $70,000 a year. Then you meet Joshua Gill from the Lower Kuskokwim School District in rural Alaska, and he offers you a job paying $52,000 a year. Which do you pick?
For a kid coming out of school, that's an $18,000 difference.
Gill is in charge of hiring people for his district. $70,000 a year for a new teacher may be a jaw-dropper, but Gill says that actually happened when he was recruiting in the Lower 48 this spring. School districts offering more money got to take their pick.
And then you've got to convince somebody to come to Bush, Alaska, where we have some teacher housing that doesn't have running water. They have honey buckets, gray water systems, and trying to convince them to go live in a village thousands of miles away from their families.
But recruiting is just part of Alaska's challenge. Tony McFadden says the bigger problem is there are fewer teachers.
Nationwide, our country is facing a severe teacher shortage.
McFadden is with Alaska Teacher Placement. They connect teachers with Alaska school districts. That partly means holding job fairs. Their biggest one of the year drew between 200 and 250 people.
And that has been a steady decline. People remember from the 80s when there were over 1,000 teachers looking for jobs in Alaska.
She says Alaska school districts hire about 800 teachers from out of state each year. Close to 200 more come from inside the state.
Fewer people are going into teaching as a career. About 50% of the teachers leave teaching as a career during the first 3 to 5 years, even to the point that some of our colleges are cutting back on teaching classes.
Alaska Teacher Placement counted 155 open teaching positions and 90 special education positions across the state at the beginning of August.
We're looking at weeks before school starts, and we have 90 elementary teacher positions that we need.
McFadden says about half of the state's school districts still need teachers. She says that's similar to last year.
And so we'll have substitutes in classrooms getting the year started with children when it's so important to have their teacher there establishing routines and getting learning started.
Another piece of the problem is teacher turnover. Just ask Dana DeFeo, a researcher with the Center for Alaska Education Policy Research.
So we recently calculated the per teacher cost of turnover, but we calculated that it is about $20,400 every time a teacher turns over.
That money comes from things like recruitment costs, hiring, training, and teacher productivity. DeFeo says between 2013 and 2014, out of the 1,095 teachers who left jobs in their districts, almost 90% stopped teaching in Alaska. She says 80% of teachers who leave rural Alaska leave the state education system. She doesn't have more recent numbers, but says that was a steady trend for 5 years. Todd Hess heads up human resources for Anchorage School District, and he says he knows teachers who said they were leaving the state because of uncertainty over Alaska's education funding. Earlier this summer, the Anchorage School District sent layoff notices to about 200 teachers while they waited for the legislature to pass an operating budget and decide how much money Alaska schools would have for this school year. When legislators passed the budget days before the start of the new fiscal year, the district canceled the layoff notices, but not before stressing out a lot of educators. Meanwhile, in the Lower 48, DeFeo says there's a strong economy, growing teacher salaries, and a short supply of teachers, making a perfect storm for teacher recruitment in Alaska. And you know, I'm Quinton Chandler.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the growing expense of providing safe water in rural Alaska.
I drink it right out of the faucet. It's good. I make the best water in town.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
The largest air carrier in Southwest Alaska has filed for bankruptcy protection. Danny Siebert is the CEO of Penn Air.
Penn Air late last night filed for reorganization under Chapter 11. And there's a number of reasons for this. I won't go into all the reasons, but we're going to reorganize the company. We're shutting down our Portland and our Denver operations immediately. And we're going to focus on the state of Alaska.
Siebert says the Chapter 11 reorganization will not affect scheduled flights in Alaska, where the company serves eight communities, mostly in Bristol Bay and the Aleutians. Penn Air's Boston flights won't be affected either, but the airline is closing operations in Portland and Denver. Siebert expanded into those markets as he tried to turn the regional air carrier into a more formidable airline.
That isn't working out for us, so we have to reorganize and focus on what made us successful in the past, which is Alaska.
The bankruptcy filing comes 2 months after Penn Air canceled daily freight service to Unalaska, citing declining revenue from its contract with the U.S. Postal Service. Siebert says about 2 years ago, he spent $27 million on five Saab 2000s, which replaced the Saab 340s used previously on the Southwest Alaska routes. The 340s were sent to the lower 48, but the 2000s proved problematic, and the company posted the worst scheduled reliability rates in its history. Peninsula Airways was founded in 1955 by Danny's father, Orrin Siebert, who began operations with a 1946 two-seater Taylor craft he flew out of Pilot Point. For most of the year, Penn Air provides the only scheduled service to Anchorage for its Southwest Alaska destinations. The village of Angoon's drinking water comes from a lake held up by a beaver dam. That might sound sketchy, but the beavers are one of the reasons the city has public water. Not all Alaska towns do. For about the past 7 years, the federal dollars for Alaska's water and sewer projects has remained flat. That's a big problem in rural parts of the state, where the existing infrastructure is getting old and the cost to replace or upgrade those systems is growing. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins visited Angoon to find out more.
This here's where the water comes up from the lake, and it goes up this way in the green pipe.
Caretaker Paul Thomas is showing me around Angoon's water treatment facility, a small rectangular building at the end of a dirt road. Metal pipes snake along the walls. Thomas says his favorite part of the job is removing the crud from the filters.
Getting these cleaned out so that I'm not getting my town sick is just doing this job, I guess, is kind of fulfilling.
Before he got this job a few years ago, Thomas says he didn't pay much attention to where Angoon's water came from. He used to keep one of those water filtration pitchers in his fridge just in case, but not anymore.
A lot of people here, I see when I go to the store, they're buying water bottles still, so I just tell them, well, hey, I drink it right out of the faucet. It's good. I make the best water in town.
But the best water in town comes at a price. One that Albert Kukesh III, who works for the city, says is growing. We take a short walk from the treatment facility to Oktaw Lake, Angoon's water source. It's a deep green color and flanked by trees. The thing that's not visible is a natural dam holding it all in, a beaver dam.
So theoretically, if that dam did break, what would happen?
The water level would drop drastically. I don't know if it would all go. But I know that it would drop. That's the million-dollar question.
Kukesh says there are some upgrades that could make Angoon's water system more reliable and affordable, like building actual levees, not just the ones created by tiny paws. There's also interest in getting solar panels for the treatment facility. Right now, the water is pumped up to it using electricity, which can be expensive since the city runs on diesel. To pay for the water treatment, Angoon uses a combination of city taxes and a yearly appropriation from the legislature. But it's still difficult for the city to break even. Part of the reason, Kukesh says, is unemployment in Angoon is high. And there's a number of people who can't afford to pay their monthly water bill.
We at the city know that because, we're in the same boat as them.
The piping system that brings the water into town wasn't constructed with shutoff valves. So when someone doesn't pay their bill, the city can't shut their water off. Instead, it winds up paying the cost. Kukesh says he's not sure how much longer that can continue. If nothing changes in 2 or 3 years, and Goon might have to limit around-the-clock running water for everyone.
And, you know, that's something that, you know, we don't want to do in Angoon, but it's something that you know, we might have to do. Not something fun to think about, especially for somebody that grew up with water and flushing toilets. You know, you want to make sure that option's always there.
There's a very large need for upgrading some of the older systems around the state, just like Angoon.
That's Bill Griffith, the facilities manager at the state's Department of Environmental Conservation. He oversees the Village Safe Water Program. About 190 small communities can't afford to fix their systems without some kind of help. Griffith says his agency has identified $1.7 billion of water and sewer projects in Alaska that need to be addressed. But every year, they only get about $60 million in state and federal funding. A drop in the bucket.
It's really just kind of a Band-Aid at this point.
He says a lot of the infrastructure in rural Alaska was built back in the 70s and 80s, constructed with federal grants and a state match. But since 2009, the congressional allocation for those projects has remained flat. President Donald Trump's budget for next fiscal year proposes zeroing out some of that grant funding. Still, Griffith says there's always the option the state legislature could put more money back in, on top of the federal match.
I don't think that's very likely, given the current budget situation in Alaska. It's unlikely that they're going to make funds available in excess.
For now, Griffith says Angoon's best bet is to try to upkeep its existing water system. Unfortunately, it's not on top of the list to receive additional funds. Unlike some other places in Alaska, Angoon actually has running water. That's not the case for about 30 Alaska communities. Albert Kukesh III says, at least in the meantime, nature is providing.
You know, the beavers are still there, you know, doing their thing, but it's something that the beavers created and we've definitely taken advantage of.
For how much longer, Kukesh says he isn't sure. He jokes that beaver hunters aren't welcome in town. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Angoon.
An Anchorage firefighter badly hurt during training is making progress in a Colorado hospital amid an outpouring of support from Alaska. 29-year-old firefighter Ben Schultz fell from a ladder in June and was in critical condition for a time. Schultz had been in an unconscious or semi-unconscious state ever since, says Fire Captain Jason Dolph. That is, Dolph says, until a week ago.
He said a few words. He said mom and dad and hi. And over the last week, he is just, it's been leaps and bounds every single day.
Dolph says it was heartening news to Schultz's supporters, many of whom were on hand for an Anchorage fundraiser on Friday at Elite Sports Performance that raised more than $100,000 for Schultz's long-term medical care.
You know, typically people are calling 911 when they're in crisis and we're coming to help them. And in this particular instance, we kind of put that 911 message out to the community and said, we need your help. It's one of our own.
Ben Schultz's father, Jeff Schultz, says the community answered that call. The Schultzes have been with Ben for weeks in Colorado.
Alaska and Alaskans, special place and special people. So it makes me proud to live there for sure. Ben's lived there all his life and he's, you know, one of Anchorage's finest. So they do good work. And people appreciate that.
Jeff Schultz says his son still has a tough road ahead of him. Links to the fundraising account for Ben Schultz are at our website, alaskapublic.org. State and federal firefighters are mopping up a wildfire in the Copper River Valley. The Chistochina fire started Friday along the Tok Cutoff, and the Alaska Fire Service reports that water drops, smoke jumpers, and ground crews stopped the blaze at 98 acres, just short of reaching four homes. Work continued over the weekend to secure the fire's perimeter. The cause of the blaze is under investigation. Unalaska has experienced three entangled whales in the last 2 years. There used to be only one person on the island who could respond to the incidents, but thanks to a recent training, a new response team is in place. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
On a sunny Tuesday night, about a dozen people are gathered on a dock. They're practicing the skills needed to free a stranded whale.
Whales up! Whales up! Whales up! Looks like a head knot. It's gonna go down though.
Going for throw.
Overthrow. Throw's good. You're in.
Up from Hawaii to lead the course is Ed Lyman. As a large whale entanglement response coordinator, he has a lot of experience freeing entangled whales. He's in town for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, working to build Unalaska's response team.
I mean, here we are at Dutch Harbor and you know, fishermen galore, right? Capital for fishing in many ways in the U.S. And so you've got a lot of skill sets there already. But I will point out that trying to cut free a 40-ton whale is unique.
Reports of entangled whales are increasing nationwide. According to the National Marine Fisheries Service, last year there were 20 confirmed entanglements in Alaska, compared to 3 in the year 2000. Until now, there was only one person in Unalaska trained to approach distressed marine mammals. That means if more help was needed, a team from the Marine Mammal Stranding Network would have to fly in. Emily Gibson is part of the new crop of responders. She's an environmental compliance manager at a local seafood processor, but says she's taking part in the class as a fisherman and resident.
We spend a lot of time on the water in the summer and, you know, interact with whales and sea whales. So we're kind of the first line of defense against these entanglements and trying to mount a response to help whales that might be in trouble out here.
Because of the potential risks to humans and marine mammals, NOAA Fisheries approves responses on a case-by-case basis. Having responders from different areas of expertise, Lyman says, is key to success.
Boy, throw a whale biologist and a fisherman together, it's the perfect team to cut a whale free. I mean, the whale biologist knows the whale behavior. The fisherman knows gear, knows the ocean, knows the boats, things of that nature. And you're putting two skill sets together to make a great team. It works, believe me.
By sharing his knowledge, Lyman hopes to protect whales while keeping humans safe. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
If you see a marine mammal in distress, report it to the Marine Mammal Stranding Network. The phone number is at alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Norton Sound commercial fishery could log near record catch and escapement numbers for all of the returning salmon species this season, except for king salmon. Like some other regions in the state, the King Run in the Norton Sound has failed to meet escapement goals. KDLG's Nick Schlino has details.
Already this season, the Sound has seen its biggest run of chum since the record was set back in 1983. The sockeye run is ranked in the top three all-time, the pinks are returning in near record-breaking numbers for an odd year, and the silvers are forecasted to show a strong return later this month.
Salmon season's been rolling along. Everything looks good this year except for the king salmon.
That's area management biologist Jim Menard. He says the commercial fishing effort on the south side of Norton Sound was slowed early in the season to protect the weak king run.
The king salmon in the Shaktulik and Unalakleet sub-districts of southern Norton Sound are a stock of concern. And there is a salmon management plan by the Board of Fisheries in how we are going to prosecute our commercial fisheries. And one of it is that we cannot commercial fish until July 1st if we're going to take any restrictions in the king salmon subsistence fishery, which we did this year.
Despite the late start, the gillnet fleet in Norton Sound could record its largest ex-vessel value in history. The chums, pinks, and sockeye are exceeding expectations, and the silvers are forecasted to have one of the top returns ever recorded. The only buyer in the region is CDQ subsidiary Norton Sound Seafood Products, and they are paying 80 cents a pound for chums and $1.40 for silvers. Menard says the river systems are all seeing strong escapement numbers.
We're busting records for chum salmon escapements. We're busting records for an odd number of year pink salmon runs, and silvers are starting out good. Sockeyes were probably going to be second best escapements we've ever seen.
The total catch for the Norton Sound is nearing 200,000 fish. Only 7,500 kings have escaped to area rivers. In Dillingham, I'm Nick Schelino.
Some Wrangell residents are opposing a state plan to store contaminated soil near a popular recreation area. But state officials say after treatment with a phosphate-based compound, the soil is now stabilized and safe. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The soil is from the old Byford junkyard, about 4 miles from downtown.
Old cars and other trash were removed a few years ago. What's left is close to 20,000 cubic yards of soil heavily contaminated with lead. The work is being overseen by the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Staffer Sally Schlichting says the soil has been treated so it's not dangerous.
This material has been stabilized permanently, so it's non-leachable. So if rain falls on it, it won't migrate out. It will just stay where it is. It's not going to get into the water.
Some residents aren't convinced. Tis Peterman shared documents describing the work via Wrangell's community Facebook page. Speaking Tuesday, she said it began an extensive and emotional conversation.
I've talked to quite a few people in the community, and a lot of them were surprised this was happening.
She says much of the concern is because the storage site is a state-owned rock quarry near Pat's Creek and Pat's Lake, about 10 miles south of town. That area is well used by community members.
Everything from paddleboarding to fishing in the creek to harvesting blueberries, any kind of berries. And in the wintertime, there's ice skating. The pit is located within a mile, I'd say, from that area.
Planning documents describe how the storage site will be covered to keep water from getting in, but it will not be lined. Schlichting also says a hydrology study shows the quarry is not connected to the creek, which flows into the lake. Another community concern is contaminated soil blowing or falling out of trucks hauling it the 8 miles from the abandoned junkyard to the quarry. Schlichting says that's being addressed.
All of the dump trucks are going to be lined and covered, and there will be a traffic control plan to prevent migration of contaminants along the whole route.
The contractor, NRC Alaska, estimates nearly 2,000 truckloads will be delivered to the storage site. Schlichting says she expects work could begin later this month, but the U.S. Forest Service could put the brakes on the plan. The trucks carrying the soil will have to use a Forest Service road, which requires a permit. Tongass National Forest spokesman Paul Robbins Jr. says that could take a while.
The Tongass National Forest will not issue a road authorization before a NEPA process is completed and we've received substantial public involvement.
NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act. It requires federal agencies to assess the effects of resource development and other actions on federal property. That process can take 6 months to 2 years. State officials say the soil needs to be moved out of the junkyard because it's not fully secured and threatens the marine environment. They say they looked at shipping it south, but that would cost twice as much. I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
And a correction tonight. A story we ran on Friday about the state's prescription drug monitoring program reported that House Bill 74 required changes to reporting the number of opioid prescriptions being written. It was, in fact, Senate Bill 74. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Laura Craigle and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Quentin Chandler, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Nick Schlino and Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.